right, we're beginning here on the bottom of Samach Vavam and Bet. Amar Rava. Have a Yativna Kameid Rav Nachman. I was sitting before Rav Nachman. Rava is a Talmud of Rav Nachman, says Rabba Amuvhak. And we know plenty of stories where Rava is sitting in the Beit Din with Rav Nachman, asking him questions, querying about the Pesukei Halacha. And so too over here, we just had a Pesak Halacha from Rav Nachman, which Rava wants to challenge, which is Rav Nachman says that there is Mechila, which is that when you have a case where you make a kinyan on Davar Shalo Bali Olam, so there we had the machloke between Rav Huna and Rav Nachman as to what the status of such a kinyan is even when the peirot appear and then come about. But then Rav Nachman in the end said, Modina, I agree to you, Rav Sheshet, that if he already ate the peirot, that he doesn't have to disgorge that. He doesn't have to give that back, that there is mechila. So underlying here is what the Gemara stated yesterday, is mechila b'taut, havya mechila. That when you forgive something, give up ownership of something, even under a mistaken premise, even though you didn't really have to give it up, that mechila is deemed to be a mechila. So that's what Rav Nachman said in that case. We saw in the other case, in the question of the Gemara, derived from the fact that Rav Nachman says, hadra ara, hadra peire. In the case here, by us, that you have to give back the land, plus you have to give back the peirot, which makes it sound like that mechila b'taot, lo shmei mechila, that when you make a mistake with the mechila, here where there's an asmachto, and the land didn't really belong to you, and you ate the peirot, you have to disgorge the land and the peirot. So over there, there's no mechila. We ended off yesterday with the Gemara that the difference was ha-mecher, ha-hova'a. One's a transaction, one is a loan. We saw the machlok between Rashi and the Balei HaTosafot as they had explained that. Rava now is coming to ask Rav Nachman on this idea that mechila b'taot, havya mechila. That when you mistakenly grant someone rights, and then they take advantage, and they utilize whatever rights you've given them, the fact that you don't have to disgorge it because it's mechila, is that really true? So he said, after Rav Nachman said this, by the oat ve'ona'a, I wanted to jump on him and ask him from ona'a, va'odit. He preemptively saw that we were going to ask the question, v'chazitan, he says, take a look at ilonit. Take a look at the case of Ilonit. So Rav Nachman understands there's a problem with Ona'a, but preempting them before they could ask the question, he tells them, take a look at Ilonit. So obviously Ilonit is supportive of his position. Ona'a is problematic for his position. Vare, Ona'a. Ona'a, here is the explication of the question. The mechila b'ta'uti. It's a mechila by mistake. V'lo havya mechila. And yet, it is not a mechila. So this is Rava's question. Rava's question is, when the person sells him something at too much of a discounted price, or the buyer is paying too much of a premium, that is ona'a. Yet we say, even though there was a mistake in the price, and Rav Nachman says, when you make a mistake, it's a mechila, even if there was a mistaken premise to whatever happened. So over here too, why don't we say the ona'a is mechila? That he paid for it, it was a mistake, but he's mochel on it. Ve'odik chazitan ailonit. And again, he preemptively saw that we were going to ask the question, and he pointed us to ailonit, which is, alright, ailonit, de mechila b'ta'uti. The case of ailonit is a mechila mistakenly, v'havya mechila, and there it works. So that is supportive of me. The Tanan, there's a Mishnah in Yevamot, shows up in Ketubot as well, ha-mema in it. A young girl who's only married midrabanan and has the right to annul her marriage through miyun. Vehashnia. Shnia means someone who's shniot la'arayot. They're not asur midoraita to marry. They're only asur midrabanan to marry because these are arayot derabanan. Vailonit. And a marriage where the woman is found to be unable to bear children. Ein lehem loktuba. Velo peirot, velo mizonot, velo bilaot. They are not entitled to any of these items. Now, by the case of the shnia, most of these items are penalties, which is that we want to disengage them from this marriage or discourage them from this marriage. And so all of these items are penalties. The mema'enet, when she has a right to annul the marriage, So the reason they allowed for such a rabbinic marriage is because this girl was already married, and now she is divorced, or a case where she hasn't been married but her father passed away, so no one has Torah rights to marry her off. So we grant those rights, midrabanan, to her mother, to her brother, in order to marry off. The way Rashi explains it over here is, Rabbanan hu detikin nisuin liyatomim, shalei nagu ba minag hefker. So that she shouldn't just be a free for all. Vishmerena bala. And her husband will take care of her. Ve'imamru desagila bimiyun. And they say that she has a right to exit the marriage through annulment. Again, this is in a period of time where the girls are getting married. Let's say roughly between the age of 9 and 12, that's when they're getting married. So if this girl has no one who can marry her off until she turns to the requisite age, she's going to be lost running around. She doesn't have a father anymore to support her. And it would be much better for her to be married and with someone who will take care of her, a baal who will take care of her. So we instituted midrabanan, an ability to generate that marriage. But with that also came a rabbinic way to annul the marriage, which is called miyun. So now, ain't like tuba. She doesn't have a ktubah, which means even what she brings in with her nindunya, and they placed it into the ktubah, so it's not just the core amount of the ktubah we're speaking about here, we're speaking about even the additional items, because she is the one initiating over here. She is the one annulling the marriage. The ktubah is a guarantee of protection from the husband when the husband divorces her or pushes her out. So there she has entitlement to whatever it is because he's the one forcing her out. Over here where she is the initiator and she's the one leaving, then she gets no ktubah. She doesn't have any entitlement to the ktubah. Part of this also might be, number one, a dissuasion for her to annul the marriage. Also, maybe incentive for the husband to marry her with the risk that he knows that she can walk away or annul the marriage. I mean, that there's risk on both sides over here in terms of the marriage. The mere fact that she can walk away already makes it risky for him to marry her. So we say, look, you're not going to have to pay out a ktubah if she walks away. You'll keep whatever's in the ktubah. And for her, you need to know you're going to lose that if you walk away. So it helps to bind or keep the glue of the marriage together. But then, since she has the right to walk out, she will lose her ktubah. Now, by the shniyah arayot, she loses the ktubah because it's a knas. That is something that we're penalizing her for. The ailunit loses her ktubah because of the fact that it was a mekach ta'ut. There was a mekach ta'ut over here. He married her with a mistaken premise that she was a child-bearing woman. That's an underlying assumption in every marriage that they intend to get married and the marriage will be able to produce children. If the woman is unable to produce children, then it is a mekach ta'ut. Now here it's a mekach ta'ut because the woman herself has features or whatever distinguishes her as an ailunit that makes it that she is unable to bear children. And it's also clear that it's her that can't bear the children over here. There is some sort of physical indication of that fact that she hasn't matured as a woman. Even though when she enters into the marriage and gives over her nedunya to him, the reason she's giving it over is because she thinks that there will be a sustained marriage over here. So the ta'ut runs both ways, which is that he has a mekach ta'ut in marrying her, but she also, when she gives over the ktubah, whatever is assigned in the ktubah and the dowry, she's only doing that because she thinks she's going to have a sustained marriage with this individual. So her giving of that over to the baal is also a mistake. So then why, like you're asking, doesn't she get it back? Because she's also mekach ta'ut. Havya mechila b'ta'ut, havya mechila. This is exactly what we wanted to prove, which is that she is waiving her right, even though mistakenly, and yet we deem it to be binding, which is that the ailunit, when she enters the marriage and gives over her property in the ktubah to her husband, she does it under the premise or the thought that they are going to be married and have a sustained marriage. And when the husband goes ahead and then takes that property, utilizes that property, or everything he does with it, is because she granted him those rights, assuming the marriage would be there. Now that the marriage is being dissolved because there was a mekach ta'ut, we still say that she doesn't get back her ktubah. Why not? We suggest this mechila b'ta'ut havi mechila. The fact that she granted him all these rights, even under a mistaken premise, nevertheless, it's binding, or it's effective, and he gets to keep whatever he got. He gets to keep. And this is the proof to Rav Nachman's position that mechila b'taut, havi mechila. Now, as far as velo peirot, they're not entitled to peirot. Rashi over here explains that the case of peirot is, even though she'en lehem takanat peirot, they don't have the takanat peirot. If you remember, it's a while back from the Gemara in Ketubot, that peirot, or the right to eat the peirot from the nichasim that she brings into the marriage, the nichse malog that she brings into the marriage, he has a right, the husband has a right to the peirot, the output, the leasehold on that property. And that is in exchange for the fact that he will be podeher if she's taken into captivity. So that's a quid pro quo. He will redeem her. She gives him the peirot. Chazal in the Ketubah set up certain items where the husband got rights. In exchange for those rights, he also grants rights to his wife. So the right that he's granting her is that he will redeem her. The right that she's granting him is the ability to eat the peirot. So even though he does not have an obligation to redeem her, because the obligation to redeem her, as Rashi brings the language over here, is Votvinach le'intu. I will redeem you and take you back as my wife. In all of these cases, that is not possible. Because in the case of the Shnia l'Arayot, it's an illicit and illegal marriage. So if he goes and redeems her, he's not redeeming her, bringing her back to be together with him. By the Ilonit, it's a mekach ta'ut, the marriage is being dissolved. He's not going to bring her back and marry her because it's a marriage that might be problematic if he has no children, because he can't be mekayim pru urvu. And even not, he didn't waive that right to not bearing children unless it's specified up front. If it's specified up front, there's no mekach ta'ut, and then none of this is relevant. So there, he's not going to take her back. And by the miyun, the girl refused. She walked away. And she annulled the marriage. So he has no obligation to redeem her now because he's going to be taking back her to wife. Despite that fact, he does not have to disgorge the peirot that he ate. He consumed peirot during the time period that they were married. And in consuming those peirot, he should have been obligated to redeem her. And that was the quid pro quo. The benefit of eating the peirot is that he's going to redeem her. Yeah, despite the fact that he is not going to redeem her, he does not need to give back the peirot. And again, here, for the shniyah, it's a penalty. For the miyun case, the case of the girl annulling it, is because she walked out, so she loses out. And by the case of the ilonit, it becomes similarly a mechila b'taut, shma mechila. She gave it in thinking that they had a marriage and gave him that entitlement, but it wasn't that way, but she gave it with that mistaken premise, and now that the premise has been proven to be wrong, we consider it a mechila, and again, that's the proof to Rav Nachman over here. And then, velo bla'ot, Rashi says over here, bla'ot are a case where she brought in clothing to the dowry, and then the husband has the right to utilize that clothing or whatever she brought in during the marriage, and then she gets back what are called the bla'ot. The wear and tear on the clothing he's not responsible for, but the remainder, the residual, goes back to her. So Rashi says that the bla'ot, he doesn't have to give back. He doesn't have to give or disgorge that back to the woman. And what you see from all these is alma mechilat achilat peirot, afal bud shebetkut machla lo mechilahi. That all of these things we see that is regards to the case of the ilonit, she forgave or gave him rights to do this, despite the fact that the marriage is going to be unwound in the end. And a mekach ta'ot, we don't demand that he give it back. We say that he gets to keep it. And again, there's not a reason for a penalty. There's not a reason for saying that she's not entitled. But there, it's a mekach ta'ut. It's going to be taken apart. And we say whatever she put in, she lost. She was mochel, even though it was under a mistaken premise that they would remain married. Nevertheless, it stays in place. And that is the proof to Rav Nachman. Just as an aside, the Balei Tosafot in many places disagree with Rashi with regards to his explanation of these items. Over here, you can see that with regards to mizonot, which is one of the things that Rashi did not explain over here, which is lo mizonot, Balei HaTosafot say, well, what is the scenario? If she's still married, then the husband's responsible for the mizonot, and he's responsible for whatever she expended at mizonot. If they are divorced, or the marriage is over, he's not chayav in the mizonot. So where is this scenario or situation in which he doesn't have to pay for mizonot? So the Balei Tosafot say it's a case, It's a case where a husband went overseas. Ve'lavta v'achla. She borrowed money in order to provide for herself mizonot. Her husband's gone. She has no way to pay for it, so she borrowed money. Ve'amda umiana. And then she annuls the marriage before the husband comes back, or even when the husband comes back, but before he's paid back that loan. Ve'ilonit nami yesh tefaresh binyan zeh. Says Ilonit, you can explain in the same way, where she borrowed money to pay for her mizonot, which in normal circumstances he'd be responsible to repay the loan that she took out because he was responsible for the mizonot. And so therefore, when this all happens, he doesn't have to pay it back because he's no longer responsible. By the annulment, she loses the right to her mizonot. And same by the Ilonit, it's a mekachtot, she loses her right to the mizonot. The problem you have is by the shnia, arayot. By that case, how do you explain it? What is the scenario? Because in the case there, you want to penalize them. In that case, then she doesn't have mizonot from the outset. I mean that she doesn't have a right to mizonot because of the problem in the marriage or the illicit nature of their marriage. So then what is the chiddush? Ein la mizonot. Ein la mizonot is period. That's a part and parcel of their marriage. Elachar mita airi. It's a case where after he passed away, she thought she was entitled to mizonot like an almana, and therefore she would be able to take it from the estate, or she did take it from the estate. So if she did take it, we make her disgorge it, but we also won't allow her to take mizonot out of the estate because she has no entitlement. And that's what it means, in la mizonot, according to the Baal Tosafot, for the shnia l'arayot. In bla'ot, Tosafot argues on Rashi, and he says, "V'iyev shalomar kain." Like what Rashi says, "The b'chol makom shemayir b'blaot kayamin maskir behedja kayamin." Rashi explains that the blaot are the remaining pieces or the residual of the clothing, the worn clothing. That's what he gets to keep and doesn't have to return. Tosafot says, whenever the Gemara speaks about blaot kayamin, it uses that qualifier and says blaot kayamin. The fact here that it mentions blaot without the word kayamin means that they don't exist anymore. And therefore, he says, the case here is a case where, Hanach blaot tektanei hacha, hainu blaot she'enan kayamin. These are blaot that he already used up. He used the clothing and he wore them down till there was nothing left. Uperei tektanei, and again, peirot over here, he disagrees with Rashi, which is, la beperot she'achal kamar, not like Rashi says the peirot he already ate. Dafilu keren gufeyim achlo ein la. Because even if he, forget about if he eats the peirot, even if he eats the principal, she has no right to take it back from her. She has no recourse against him. She doesn't get the peirot that he collected. And they're still around. I mean that he picked peirot, and then she annuls the marriage. Or he picked peirot, and they find out that she's an ilonit. So then, technically, she should be able to get the peirot back, because they're still intact here. He hasn't consumed them yet. You say no, that once he's picked them and taken them down, he walks away with them. Inami, takanat peirot kamar, de'enla. Kagon shenish beit, v'lavta upadat zantma. Or, it is the quid pro quo of peirot. It's not literally peirot, but rather, the pidyon shvuim, which we actually already noted, she's not entitled to. If she was taken into captivity and borrowed money to buy her freedom, then the husband won't be responsible to pay back that loan, because he's not responsible for her pidyon shvuin, because he can't take her back as a wife. And therefore, it's the quid pro quo of peirot. When it means that she doesn't get peirot, it means she doesn't get the benefits that would come from peirot, which is pidyon shvuin. If she borrowed to release herself, he would not pay her back, similar to the way that he explained by the mizonot, the case where he borrowed. So Tosafot explains all of these cases slightly differently than Rashi, not only here, but at other places in Shas as well. So now, Rav Nachman brought his proof down, but he also has the problem that Rova noted, which is Ona'ah, says that Mechila b'ta'ot lo shmechila velohi. And the Gemara says about this, Lo Ona'ah havyatu yuftei. Ona'ah is not a question against Rav Nachman's position. Velo Ilonit misayile. And neither does Ilonit support his position. Lo Ona'ah tu yuftei. By the Ona'ah, it's not a question on him. De lo yodo. De ite Ona'ah de machil gabe. The problem is, Mechila only works when you know something's happening. If you're unaware of what's happening, you can't be mochel. We discussed this a lot when we dealt with the sugyas of Ona'ah, that part of the problem of Ona'ah, or Mechila on Ona'ah, is the fact that the buyer or seller who's being cheated over here, overcharged, underselling, is losing out, but he doesn't know he's losing out. It's one thing to say you have mechila when you know that something's been taken from you, or you're waiving your right to something. That's fine. If you know that you have that right, then you're waiving it. Over here, you don't know what you're waiving because you have no idea that he overcharged you. You have no idea that you sold it below the market price. Since you don't have that information, there's no way you can have implicit mechila, because mechila requires knowledge in order to be mochel. So therefore, it's not a question of Rav Nachman, because Rav Nachman's mechila b'ta'ot, shmei mechila, is when the person knows that you're taking the peirot. He knows that you're eating whatever it is that's there, and he waives his right, even though mistakenly he waives his right. He says, yeah, you're entitled to it, you can take it. Even though the reason he thinks that you are entitled to it is mistaken premise, nevertheless, that's mechila b'ta'ot, because you're aware. But over here, there's no awareness to have mechila. V'lo ailonit misayilin, and ailonit is also not a benefit to him. The nechila de tipukol ashma de ishut. She has a secondary interest over here, or maybe even a primary interest over here, which is that she wants to be known as married. For a woman at that time to be single, or not to have a shame of being married, we know that from the Gemara and other places, that their impetus to be married was so strong that the Gemara says sometimes, it's better just to be married than to be alone. That impetus makes it that the woman sometimes will waive her rights, maybe even do something that doesn't seem logical, or will give up her monetary rights in order to be known as a married woman. So what the Gemara says is it's not a mechila b'ta'ot, it's a mechila with knowledge. She wants to be married and known to be married, even though later on the marriage gets unwound. But for the period of time that the marriage was intact, for her, that was something that was very meaningful. And therefore she waives her rights for in exchange or in consideration of the fact that she was considered married during that time. So instead of being a mekach ta'ut, a mistaken mechila, this isn't a mistaken mechila. The premise of the mechila is still intact, which is that she wanted to be known as married. And she was known as married during that period of time. And that gives her a certain amount of satisfaction, or gives her a certain standing in the society that it's worth it to her to give up, and that doesn't go away. Even though there's a mekach ta'ut now and they unwind the marriage, but she was married for that period of time. And that shame is shult is worth something to her, and that's why she gives up her rights. Hai itzita, the amr le lahu gavra, zil zavin li ara mikrivai. This woman asks a shliach, some sort of proxy intermediary, to go and buy a certain property from her relative. Azal Zavinla. So he did it. Carried out the instructions of the principal. He executed on them. The seller of the property says to him, I want as a condition of the sale to have a right to buy it back. I want a right that if I come up with the cash, then I can claim back or redeem back the property that I'm selling to you. I'm always selling it to you under duress. And so I would like the right to buy it back if I come into the cash. As Amarle, the intermediary or the messenger says, At v'navla achai. You and navla are relatives. So now Rashi brings from the Gaonim that the word navla is a pronoun that means you and her or you and him. Either way, it's a generic pronoun that it works for the male and the female. Rashi says more simply that her name was Navla. That was her name. You and Navla are relatives. Basically, he's saying, you don't work it out with me. It's not my issue. You go work it out with your relative, because that's who's really buying the property. So now, I assume that he's not just disclosing the information now. Whoever this was aware of the fact that the woman buying the property, or the principal buying the property, was his relative. And all that information was disclosed. There's no secrets over here. But simply, he's saying, don't negotiate with me, negotiate with her. Amar Rabba Barhuna. Rabba Barhuna says about this case, anytime you have that type of expression, go speak to your relative, then Amar Samchodate Vilogamar Makne. He's relying on that, and because he's relying on that, he doesn't really sell the property with a full heart. He doesn't really give over the property because he has an assumption that he really will be able to get it back. This guy, when he said to him, it's your relative buying it, you guys work it out, The person hung his hat on that statement. And by hanging his hat on that statement, he also didn't sell it fully because he left him a window that there was this ability to negotiate with the woman who sent him. And he relies on that it's his relative and that he'd be able to negotiate it. And therefore, when he sells it, he really sells it with this underlying premise in it, or he doesn't sell it with a full heart. So therefore, arahadra, for sure the land goes back. Meaning that if he comes up with the cash, he can buy the land back because he never really sold it. Peire mai. Problem is, what to do with the peirot? Because if he didn't have a full gmirat hadat when he sold it, then what ended up happening over here is we have a loan. An effective loan that took place. The land basically became collateral for the loan, but he bought the land, but the land isn't bought because there was no gmirat hadat. So in essence, when he gave him the money, he lent him the money. And now when he comes back to buy back the karka, he's just returning the money and the land goes back to him. So you have an effective loan that went on because there was no transaction, there was no mecher here. So the peirot that the buyer ate in the interim, does he have to disgorge those peirot? That will depend on how we view the peirot. If the peirot are ribit ktsutza, full-fledged ribit midoraita, then you have to disgorge it. That was the sheet of Rabbi Elazar that we saw who argued on Rabbi Yochanan, that ribit ktsutza, you have to disgorge. If it's a vak ribit, if it's only ribit midorabanan, then you don't have to disgorge it. And that's what the Gemara is going to trying to determine. It says, peiramai, ribit ktsutza havu. This is straightforward ribit. Biyotzin b'dayanin. And therefore, it is extracted by the dayanim. Odilma ki avak ribit avu. Or maybe it's more like a var ribit. Ve'en yotzin. And therefore, you would not have to, or they would not have to disgorge the avak ribit in this case. So the question is, in this scenario, how do we view the eating of the peirot? Do we view it as being, this is a loan, and therefore it's definitely ribit tsuta? Or do we say that maybe it's still a vak ribit because it derived from a transaction. Even though there was an asmachta and it really didn't go through the transaction, but they still entered into it thinking it was a transaction and eating the fruit based on that fact. And so maybe it's only a vak ribit over here and you wouldn't be able to force them to disgorge it. So Amar Rabbi Ravuna Mistavra ki avak ribit havu, that it's similar to a vak ribit, ve'en yotzin v'dayanin, and the dayanim can't extract it or they can't take it out. V'chein amar Rava. Rava also says something similar. And the other girl says, V'chein amar Rava. Ki avak ribit avu v'en yotzin b'dayanin. And it's considered to be avak ribit, and the dayanim can't take it out, or that there is no disgorgement of the interest, because it's only interest midrabanan. Amar le abaye the Rava, mashkanta mai. What is the story with a mashkon? In a case of a mashkon, where a person gives over collateral to the individual, and then while he has the collateral, he eats the fruits or the production of the collateral without deducting anything from the loan or the principal amount of the loan. So he's clearly getting interest from his consumption of the production of the mashkon. Hatam taimamai, the reasoning behind why you say over here it's considered to be avak ribit and not ribit tsuta is mishum delo katzle. Because there is no fixed payment. The interest over here is not interest in the sense of you pay me 10% a year, you pay me a certain percentage of the loan outstanding value every year. You're simply taking whatever is produced by the land. So over there, again, when the transaction was done and there was an asmachto, so there really wasn't a transaction, we deem it a loan. But when he takes interest on the loan, he's not getting a fixed amount every year. He doesn't have a guaranteed payment on it. He gets whatever the land is producing. He gets whatever is there, up, down, whatever it is. Tzachanami, lo katzle. So over here too, by the mashkon, it's not a fixed payment or a fixed interest payment. And therefore, it also be deemed to be a vak ribit. And if it's a vak ribit, he won't have to disgorge it. Odilma, hotam zvine. Maybe over there, the transaction started out as a transaction and not a loan. It got flipped into a loan because the transaction failed because the kinyan was problematic because there was an asmachta. There was this belief that he thought he could get out of the deal and therefore he never really gave it over with a full heart. And because of that, it flipped into being like a loan, but it started as a transaction. And that's why it's mutar over there. It's only, not mutar, but that's why it's considered to be a vak ribit and not ribit ktsuta. But over here, it all started out as a loan. no mecher involved here. He simply took this as collateral for his loan. So he extended a loan from day one. And so maybe that's the difference between mecher and halva'ah. So that's what he wants to understand. He's trying to understand, over there, why were you guys matir and saying that it was a vak ribit and not ribit tzutza? There are two possibilities as to why they said that. Either because it's not a fixed yearly payment, it's not a fixed payment on the loan, therefore it's not deemed to be interest midoraita, or is it because it came through a transactional commitment, not a loan? It flipped into being a loan or changed it to be a loan, but that's not how it started. It started as a transaction. So those are the two possibilities as to why before they thought it was ribit the Rabbanan and not ribit the Oraita. So Rabbi says, well, if I go to Mashkon, by Mashkon, I have one of those two reasons. I have the fact that it's not a fixed payment per year because you're eating the payroll or the production per year. But on the other hand, it isn't Mecher. There it's clearly a loan. So which of the two is the reason, and then can I apply it to Mashkon? They responded to Abaye. Rabbi responds to Abaye. The reasoning over there was it wasn't a fixed payment. That's why it's a vak ribit. And so to over here, it's not a fixed payment. It's considered to be a vak ribit. And therefore, you would not have to disgorge the profits. And that would be, as Rashi notes over here, upaliga de Rav Nachman. This position argues on Rav Nachman. Because if you remember, Rav Nachman said yesterday, hadra ara, hadra peire. He says the land goes back, and so do the peirot. You have to disgorge not only land when there was an asmachta in that case, and you took possession of the land, but you also have to disgorge the peirot. And so what Rashi notes over here is that's different than what we're saying here. Here we're saying that when there was an asmachta problem in the kinyan, you have to give back the land, but you do not have to give back the peirot, because it's considered to be a vak ribit. So that would argue in Rav Nachman, and Amar Papi, Avad Ravina Uvda, Ravina had a case like this, V'choshiv Apik Peire Deloka Rabba Baravuna. He went ahead and forced them to disgorge the peirot against the position of Rabba Baravuna, but in concert with Rav Nachman's position, which is that when you have a problem in the Kinyan, and Asmachta in the Kinyan, not only do we force you to give back the land, we force you to give back the peirot, which is what Ravina is saying here, similar to Rav Nachman's position from yesterday, but against what Rabba Bar Rav Huna just said over here, that you don't have to give it back because it's a vak ribit. Right now, there's an important Tosafot over here. Baya Tosafot over here say, peirot maik ribit tutsadami v'yotzin. What is the status of the peirot? Tosafot says, afagav demashma hocha, dehadra peirot lo hadru elamitam davi ribit tutsad. The reason that you have to give back the peirot over here is because there's real interest. That would be the only reason. Mikol makom, Ravina the apik peirot, Ravina, who we just read in the case now, gave back the peirot. Al korchach lav mihai taima. It's clear that's not what he believes, because he brings the case that we had back on Daf Samach Bet, and over there, he says that it's not a problem of ribit ksuta, it's only a problem of avak ribit. So how do I reconcile between Ravina's position here that you have to give back the fruits and the fact that he doesn't believe that such a transaction is considered to be ribit tzuta? Ela tzarich lomar, the time of Ravina, mishum davia mechila betaut, velo havia mechila. So he says the reason behind Ravina is because it was a mechila, granting of a right, and that granting of the right is not a mechila. Bedavka bezvine, Kain uvda deraba baravuna afik ravina peri velo behalva'a. And the only time he forces the disgorgement then is a case where it was a transaction and not in a case where it was a loan. The reason being, but was similar to what we said yesterday, hatam bezvine hacha behalva'a. Unlike Rashi, who explains the problem is ribit there, the difference between mecher and halva yesterday was ribit, the Baal Yom Tosafot explained that the difference is whether there was actually a transaction that took place. By the case of asmachta, the underlying problem is in the kinyan. What you have a problem here is that there was never any kinyan made, and therefore he never had a right to the property to start with. So since he never had a right to the property, eating the peirot or saying there's mechila on the peirot is problematic, because the person who gave it over, even though he thought there was a transaction, there was no transaction whatsoever. So that's what Tosafot said, we talked about at the end of yesterday's daf. Says over here, it's different, and it is ribit kutsutza. The lo mitam ribit kutsutza yotzim, elo klomar mishum de mechila bataot, lo avi mechila. Yotzim kimo ribit kutsutza diotza. Not to say that over here the reason you're getting it back is it's Ribit Tuta, but it's a Mechila like Ribit Tuta, which is forced out. Says that explanation, the Rebbeinu Tam, doesn't make any sense. If you look in the Hagot Agra, he says, the Rosh says the same thing. They disagree with the Balei Tosfot over here and say the reason you have to disgorge it is because it is considered or classified as Ribit Tzutzah. And so they, similar to Rashi, as the Gra pointed out yesterday, they believe like Rashi, the reason there's disgorgement over here is because it is full-fledged Ribit. And so now you have a machloket both about how to explain the Gemara at the end of yesterday's daf, Hatam Zvinei Hochachalva, as well as our Gemara over here as to the reason you have to disgorge. Rashi, the Rambam, the Rif, think that the reason you have to disgorge is, Rashi calls it Mechseik Ribit Tzuta, but the Rif and the Rambam call it Ribit Tzuta. This is real Ribit, and since it's real Ribit, you gotta give it back. There is a forced disgorgement. If it's a Vak Ribit, you don't have to give it back. And when Ravino over here says you give it back, it's because it's Ribit Tzuta. When we said before, Rav Nachman said it was a Mechila or wasn't a Mechila, it depended if it was Ribit Tzuta or not Ribit Tzuta. As opposed to that, you have the Shita, the Balei HaTosafot, to say that the reason for disgorgement over here is it's a Mechila B'taot. But there's a difference. A Mechila B'taot in a Halva'a is considered to be a Mechila. But a Mechila B'taot by a Zvinei, by a Mecher, is not considered to be a Mechila. So in the case of Mecher, it's a Mechila B'taot that is Chozer because the underlying transaction totally falls apart. Whereas by Halva'a, the Mechila B'taot works because it's only a Vak Ribit, and it stays in your possession. So the Balei Tosafot, given their reason from yesterday, apply it to the Gemara today. And similarly, Rashi, the Rambam, the Rif, will use their reasoning also over here to say why there's a disgorgement. Okay, Amar Mar Breid Rav Yosef Mishmei Derava. Hai Mashkanta. If you have a Mashkon, Ba'atra de Misalke, in a city where they can throw you off the Mashkon, you give over collateral, but the Lova has a right at any time to come in, pay the money for the loan that's outstanding, and take the Mashkon back. He has the option to buy it back at any moment. Achal Shir Zuzei Misalkinan Le. If the borrower over here brings him to court, after the guy has eaten sufficient fruits to pay down the principal, and even go, this is not a Mashkanta Benechaita. There was no agreement that they would defease the loan based on how much he ate. Simply a mashkon that sits with him. And in this city, the mashkon sits with the lender, and he eats whatever is on the property. If the borrower catches him at a point where he has not eaten sufficient to be in excess of the principal amount, but the principal amount, then, misalkinanle, we throw him off the property, and we basically say, you ate your principal amount, out of here, you don't can't stay on here anymore. On the other hand, achal tfei, if he ate more than that, lo mafkinimine, we can't force him to disgorge that, because at that point it becomes a vak ribit. And once it's a vak ribit, the courts can't interfere in order to force him to disgorge the avak ribit. So if the, as Rashi says over here, if the debtor gets him at the right time, afagav de avak ribitu, veino yotzeh b'dayanin, his simple eating of the fruits, in essence, is avak ribit all the way along. But here, hani mila de batar de shakle, that's only after he's already taken it. This guy caught him quickly and stopped him after he had only eaten just the amount that was equal to the principal amount. So when he comes in, he's saying, look, you already ate your principal amount. You took whatever it belonged to you. Add it. That's it. If he exceeds that and then the lover comes in, you have a problem because then whatever's in excess of that is called a avak ribit. And the avak ribit, he can't force him to disgorge in the court. Also, ein mechashvin mishtara l'shtara. If he has multiple debts outstanding with this individual, and he gave the land as collateral for one of those debts, we don't say that, well, if he ate in excess of this shtar, we'll just apply it to the other shtar. We don't do that. Each shtar is independent, and the collateral applies to whichever shtar it was given for. Obediyatme. On the other hand, by cases of yitomim, achal shiur zuzei misalkinanle. If he ate up to the keren, we throw him off. Achal tfei, mafkinamine. He ate more than that, we still throw him off. We still get the money back and force him to disgorge, even though it is a vak ribit. Although, as the Gra points out over here, the Rambam and Nirif also had a girsa tfei lo mafkinim minei. They had a girsa that we don't disgorge it. Umechashvina mishtar l'shtara. For them, the difference between the yatom and the other case is this, that we do allow them to apply the principal amount of both shtarot to the collateral or to the items that he's eating. So that would be the kula according to Rambam Nirif. According to the others, the other kula is here that even the avak ribit, we force them to disgorge for yitomim. And Rashi says over here, shebeitin shbeir avien shel yitomim, that the beitin of the city is the father of the yitomim. This is something that Rabban Gamliel said explicitly in the Gemara. It is something that the modern law and the secular courts today recognize that the courts are the protectors of the children and protectors of the yitomim. And it derives from this right here, where they say that the courts are the protector of the children. And therefore they are demanded or empowered to do what is right. They don't give up the right to collect the excess. And it's as if they threw him off the field at the time that he ate the principal amount. And we deem it as if they are not machul, and Beit Din steps in to protect the yitomim. And that's why it doesn't go through, or he doesn't get to keep it. Amar Rav Ashi, hashta d'amart, now that you say, achal tfei lo mafkinim inei, if he eats in excess, then you can't take it away from him. Achal shu zuzei, nami lo misalklin inei below zuzei. Then, when he ate up to the principal amount, you can't throw him off without payment. My daima. Why is that? Sluke below zuzei, afuke mineihu. He says, well, if you throw him off the property without paying him any money, then the reason you're taking this is because of the amount that he ate. Have avak ribit. What he ate was only avak ribit. Avak ribit enu yotzabi dayanim. And avak ribit cannot be removed except through dayanim. So now, what you have here, what his statement is that when the person takes the mashkom and eats the peirot on the mashkom, you have to say in the end that if he eats more than the principal amount, you're saying that it's avak ribit, then even the principal amount that he ate was also avak ribit. The whole time when he's eating the peirot over here, he's not eating the peirot with the intent to defease the loan or to pay back the loan. He's eating the peirot because he gets that benefit. He gets that rebeat. It's his benefit for lending you the money. And so therefore, if we're going to say when it's greater than the principal amount, that is considered to be a avak ribit, then even the principal amount is also a avak ribit. And when you go to force him to disgorge it, you're trying to force him to disgorge a avak ribit. Even though you're saying, well, it's equal to the principal amount, and that's really just prepayment of the principal, that's you after the fact trying to say that the value that he took was principal. But the truth is, what he took was a avak ribit, and that's how he's eating it all the way along. For that reason, Rav Ashi says that you have no rights to force him to disgorge it, not with regards to the principal, nor with regards to the excess of the principal amount. Avad Rav Ashi uvdo b'yitomim ktanim kigdolim. Rav Ashi had a case with yitomim, and he treated them like gdolim. Kasavar mitchilat achilatan avak ribit. Because he believes from the moment they start eating it, it's avak ribit. Vein koach v'dayanim l'otzio. And dayanim don't have a right to take it out. The reason Rashi stated before that dayanim had a right to take them off the property and keep the avak ribit was because it started out as principal amount. And since it started out as principal, they basically said to them, you're done after the principal amount. And then everything you eat after that, you didn't have permission to eat. But over here, if we start from day one or from grand zero, you start as it being a avak ribit, then the dayanim never had a right to throw him off or never had a right to force a disgorgement. If that's the case, they can't claim, oh, you eat it illegally, we took it back already. They can't take it back because they have no rights to go after it. So Rav Ashi says you got to be consistent, which is that if you believe that in excess of the principal amount is avak ribit, then you really believe the whole thing is avak ribit. You really believe everything is avak ribit, and it's just semantics that you're calling the first part principal and the remainder of avak ribit. It's really all of avak ribit, and you have no rights to take it back, as opposed to what we saw before, that we're willing to divide between if he was just ate up to the principal amount, that would be considered principal. Once he's crossed over that point and already got to avak ribit, then it turns it all into avak ribit. But then there is a threshold by which it changes. Rav Ashi says, once there's a threshold, that means from the beginning or the outset, it's all avak ribit, and there it's not subject to disgorgement, or the courts can't interfere in order to force him to return it. Rashi explains over here, why is it that the Gemara specifies here that this is in a city where they can buy it back from you, or they can take you off the land at any time? The ilu atra de lo misalke, because if it's in a city where the lender gets to keep the property for a fixed amount of time, and the lova has no rights to come and redeem the property or take it back, pay back the loan and get its mashkom back. They used to keep the property for a fixed number of years. If the lova shows up with the money, the malva says, too bad, you can't pay it back. Everybody agrees then, when he has the property during that period of time, it's a sale. Because effectively, it's not really against the loan, because the loan would be able to be repaid and then the mashkon return. The fact that he can't force you out of the mashkon shows you that you have ownership here or a mecher here. And once you have a mecher, then there's no problem to eat the fruits because it's yours. It's your field during that interim period. So Amar Rava Breda Rav Yosef Mishmei Durava. So Rav Yosef's son Rava says in the name of Rava, Hai Mashkanta. This mashkon batrad the misalke, in a place where they are allow you to pay back the loan and throw the lender off the land. Lo nechol el menechaita. The only way, or the only permissible way to eat the fruits on the land is benechaita, if you defease the loan based on that. Vitzurba mirabanan afilu benechaita lo nechol. But a tzurba mirabanan, a young Talmud Chacham, should not eat benechaita. Okay, so now let's just talk about nechaita. Nechaita, as we discussed before, is in a case where they agree to a fixed payment per year for the fruits on the property. The reason it's not considered to be interest is because he has a fixed payment irrespective of what the land produces. That means that sometimes the land will produce in excess of what he's paying. Sometimes it will produce less than he's paying. But since it's a fixed deduction per year and he's accepting the production risk or the risk that the number could be above or below what they've agreed to, that makes it that it's not interest, but rather a sale. It's a sale of the fruits or a deduction of the fruits, and that's why it is mutar. But we know from Rashi and from other places that when he does it b'nechaita, he's definitely getting it at a discount. He's not buying it at the fair value of the payrot. First of all, we don't know what the production is going to be. And also, because there's risk involved and there's a loan outstanding, he's going to buy it at a discounted rate. So that must be what the objection Rova is to this practice. It's not because it's deemed to be ribit, but it still has, I would call, a taste of ribit here. Because of the fact that it most likely will end up in you benefiting, because you're buying it at a discount, and in the majority of the time, it will end up exceeding, the production of the field will exceed the amount you paid. And so it looks like ribit, even though it's not, and even though it's fine in the letter of the law, it's still, from the optics, it looks a little bit more difficult. And we don't want people to copy you, but copy you and not do it the right way. Because then it will look like interest. And that's what Rashi says. Shetzarech liyashir drachav. He has to act better than the letter of the law. He has to act lifnim mishurat adin. Uhit kadesh afim mutar lo. And to separate even from things that are mutar. Pen yil medumi menu lilzalzel biyisurim. Because people might see them and think it's interest. Or it looks like interest. And then they'll think it's okay, or the issur of interest isn't such a big deal. So we want you to move away from anything that looks close to interest. Once again, Rashi stipulates here that this is only in a place where the lova has a right to buy you off the field, because in a place where the lova doesn't have a way or right to buy you off the field, then it's like a full-fledged mecher. And therefore you own the fruits and you can eat them because you own the field during that interim period. So then, Ella b'may nechol. How can a tzurmi d'rabanan structure it in a way that is mutar? Bikitsuta. The Gemara doesn't explain now what it is bikitsuta. It will explain in 1 second. Anicha lamanda amar kitsuta sharia. That works well for the one who says kitsuta is allowed. Lamanda amar kitsuta asira. The one who says kitsuta is problematic. Ma'ika the meimar. What are you going to say then? Then what can the rabbanan do? Or which structure can they use that wouldn't be problematic? Ditmar. Kitsuta. We have a machloket amaraim with regards to kitsuta. Pligi bar Rav Acha of Ravina. Rav Acha and Ravina argue about this. Chadamar kitsuta sharia. One of them says that kitsuta is fine. Chadamar kitsuta asira. And one of them says kitsuta is problematic. Heichi dami kitsuta. So we finally get there. What is this kitsuta that the Gemara is discussing? Damarle, he says to them, ad chamei shanim achil ne la b'lo nechaita. For the first 5 years, I'm going to eat it without any defeasance. Mikam ve'elech shamina lecha kulu peirei. From there to forward, we're going to assess the payrot that I eat each year. And those payrot, we're going to deduct or defease the loan based on the true value, whatever it is that came out or was that year's. So he gets a 5-year window where he eats and there is no deduction. And then after that point in time, there is a deduction. Igad Amre, some suggest this way. Kol b'lo nechaita asur. Wait a minute. If there is no deduction, there's no defeasant, how can you call that not in being interest? Over there, you're getting a freebie for 5 years. You don't have to take any of the loan. That's exactly a bak ribit. Why is that allowed? Aval hecha dami kitzuta. So then what is the case of kitzuta? Termalei ad chamesh shanim achilna b'nechaita. For the first 5 years, I'm going to eat it at a fixed price per year. Fixed price deduction of the principal amount. From there forward, I will assess the total value of the payrot that I eat, and we will deduct or defease the loan based on that. The one who says that the situation or the kitsuta is the first explanation we gave, which is 5 years where there's no defeasance, and after that, you defease it at the true value of the payrot. So that is considered to be kitsuta. Then you have a machloket here between Rav Acha and Ravina. One of them says mutar, one of them says asur. The one who says asur then wins the case that the rabbanon are allowed to do it. He'll be like the batraita, like the second way we explained it. So he'll say b'nechaita is asur, b'kitsuta is asur. And where is the case that the Rabbana can do? It's the last explanation that we gave over here, which is it'll be mutar in a case where he deducts v'nechaita for the first 5 years, and after that, at the true value of the payrot. On the other hand, manda asar bebashraita, if you think the definition of a kitsuta is the second explanation we gave, and therefore the machlok between Rav Acha and Ravina is about that second case, that means that one of them says it's asur even in that case, then hechi shari the meichal. Which way or what structure would it be mutar according to Rabbana? They're saying the chaita is asur. They're saying that the nechaita mixed with the kitzuta is asur. And they're saying this kitzuta is asur. So what is mutar? Sharei ki mashkanta desura. The only way that is mutar is similar to a mashkanta desura, which we're going to bump into later in the Masechta and then again in Baba Batra. The kotva bahachi that is written in it. The language that is found in this is b'mishlam shnaya ilein tipuk ara da b'lo kesef. After this number of years has elapsed, then the land goes back to you without any payment. So if 5 years, 10 years, whatever the number is, I get to use the field for that period of time. After the 5 years or the 10 year, once you hit the expiration, you get the land back and I have no claim against you. So that is a case where it's mutar. Because in essence, what you are doing is, as Tosafot explains over here, tema, ma ben zele nechaita. The case here has to be a case where the loveh has a right to throw him out in the interim, because in a case where he doesn't have the right to throw him out in the interim, there's no problem at all, because then it's a purchase and not a rebate with a loan. So it has to be a case here where the loveh has the right to remove him, and yet what we're doing is defeasing the loan over a fixed period of time. So how is this different than a normal case of defeasance where you pay him a fixed amount per year? So Tosfot says in the end, v'yesh lamar, the Macharsh Mefaresh Kain, since he explicitly says the land will go back, lo mechse kahalva, it no longer looks like a loan. Elokeach mimenu peirot shel shanim alalu b'otan damim. It looks like he's buying the peirot for that duration of time. Al sheino kotev lokach, when he doesn't do that, menacher kol shana v'shana b'fnei atzma, nirakilu mozil gabei peirot oto shana v'schar motar halva. So what the difference is in this structure, it's made clear up front that there's a end date or a date at which the land goes back automatically. That means that in essence, you're not really lending him the money. You're purchasing 5 years worth of crops, 10 years worth of crops. You're buying the production of the fields for that duration. And that's fine, because then it looks like a mecher. In the case where you do it as a nechaita, and each year you deduct a fixed amount, over there, it's never specifically stated when that will end. I mean, it's obvious. You can calculate it. You can take how much you're paying per year and figure out when the principal will be gone. But since it's not that way and you're paying on a yearly basis, it looks more like you're buying it on a yearly basis at a discount in order to allow him to keep the loan outstanding. And so the optics of it are much more like a loan and some sort of discount that's being granted to you that looks like interest. And that's why it's much more problematic. But Mashkanta Desura, where everything's explicit up front, that the loan will be gone and the land will go back, it makes it as if it's like a lease on the property for that period of time. And that's totally fine because it doesn't even look like a loan anymore, and the optics are so much better in that situation. And that's what Tosfot says. Technically, there's no difference. But the optics are different, and the optics of a mashkanta desura are much cleaner than the optics of a mashkanta binechaita. Rapapa, Rav Huna, Breder, Rav Shua, Amrei Tarvayu. They both say, Hai mashkanta, ba'atra de misalke, a mashkon in a place where you have a right to, again, the loave has a right to come in here and push the malve off the property by paying back the loan. Ein balchov go vahimenu. A balchov has no rights to collect from it. Vein abachor notel bab hishnaim. A bechor that inherits it doesn't have a double portion in it. Ushvit misham tata. And shvit would cause the loan to be forgiven. And the opposite, ba'atra delomasalke, in a city where the loave does not have a right to take you off the property. During the period of time, that 5-year period, he can't force you off the land, even if he repays the loan. It won't change anything. There, it looks much more like a mecher, and therefore, b'chov govai menu. B'chov has a right to it. B'chor notel ba pishnayim. B'chor gets a double portion in it. Vein shvit mishamta. And shvit is not mishamated. So now, let's go through them together, because it's easier to understand. The case of b'chov chove amenu is what happens if the lender over here, the creditor over here, lent money. He got back this property as a mashkon. So now, there are two scenarios. He either gets the mashkon, but the loave always has a right to come and take it back from him and buy it back from him. Or he has a mashkon where it's his for the fixed amount of time, for 5 years, whatever the period of time it is, and the loave has no rights to take it back. If it is his, then his creditors can come after that land. Because the land is his. If the land is his, the creditors come after his land. Where that becomes important is not while he's alive. Because while he's alive, he's encumbered and indebted to pay, whether it's from property, his clothing, his money, whatever he owns, he encumbered himself. When he passes away, that's when the problem exists. Because when he passes away, the only thing that remains encumbered to pay off his debts is his property. But it has to be his property. So in the case where it's a mashkon, dolo misalke, a case where the mashkon stays with him and the loave has no rights to buy it back, it is his property. And therefore, the lien of his creditors remain even after he passes away, and they can go get that property from the yitomim. On the other hand, if it's a case where the loave has a right to come and buy it back at any time, then he didn't really own the property. He owned the right of collection on a loan, and that if he defaulted on the loan, he would keep the mashkon. But in the interim, he doesn't own the property. Since he doesn't own the property, when he passes away, his creditors can't go after it because it's only metaltalim. It's not deemed to be karka. He doesn't have enough ownership in it. For the same reason, it affects shmitat ksafim. A loan with a mashkon is not subject to shmitat ksafim because there's no problem of lo yigos. The creditor is not going to pressure him for payment because he already basically has the payment in hand. He's already been repaid. The guy gives him the money, he'll return the mashkon. But there's no problem of pressure because he's holding a mashkon. But that's only true where the mashkon is considered to be in his hand or his possession. So in the case of Ba'atra Delo Masalke, in a place where they can't throw him off the land, the mashkon is really his during that period of time, then that's a halva ala mashkon. On the other hand, if it's a case where the individual can come and throw him off the property at any time and buy it back, then you have a problem. Even though, in the Gemara in Kitin, when it speaks about this, it says that if he has a mashkon that is metaltalin, and even though you'd have to return the metaltalin and be paid it back, that's still considered to be a milva ala mashkon. That is because over there it's metaltalin. And that because of the din of Rabbi Yitzchak, which we've seen in Baba Kama and Baba Tzio, we've seen it before, that Rabbi Yitzchak says that the mashkon during the period of time that you're holding it, it's considered to be yours. And then it's considered yours. When you return it, it's at staka, because you don't have to give it back. It was yours. And number two is that ownership makes it yours. If it makes it yours, that's what protects the loan from being subject to shmidat ksafim. But over here, by the land, that doesn't happen. You don't have this din of Rabbi Yitzchak, because that's by metaltalin. By karka, the only way it could be yours is if it was sold to you. But here, it's not sold to you, because he has a right to come and take it back at any moment. And therefore, this is not a sufficient mashkon in order to block it from being subject to shmidat ksafim. A bechor It's a machloket about this with regards to a bechor, but we generally paskin, and this is one of those dayot, that a bechor only has a right to muhzak, that which is in the possession of his father, but bera oy, things that will come into the possession of his father, he does not get a double portion for. So once again here, if he lent the money in a place where they can't buy back the property, it's there with him for them, then it's muhzak. He already owns the property. It's his. The bechor is entitled to a double portion. The other hand, if it's a case where the loveh can pay the loan back at any time and take the property is not his. It's ra'oy. Either the cash from the loveh, or if he defaults, the property eventually will be his. That's ra'oy to be his, but it's not his now, and therefore the bechor does not have an entitlement to a double portion. So that explains the three different items that we have here. So now the Gemara says, "V'amar mar zutra mishmei de rapapa, hai mashkanta b'd'atra de misalke." That mashkon, in a place where the loveh can come and throw him off the land, misalkele va'afilu mitamre dogadya, that he can throw him off even from the dates that are sitting on his mat. The way that Rashi explains that they used to pick the dates was they used to lay out the schach mats. They used to machalatzot. They used to roll them out. Then they would shake the tree or go up into the tree and pick it. And as they fell, they would fall onto their mats. After they fell onto the mats, they would collect them and then put them into their baskets. What he's saying here is, in a place where the loveh has the right to repay the loan and take the property back, that's even in a case where he put out his mats and the dates are sitting on the mats. The lender doesn't get to take those. He loses those. V'agvinu b'sisne kananu. If he already moved them into his baskets and lifted up his baskets, then he made a kinyan on them and they're his. So, if he makes a kinyan on them, they're already his, and the loveh can't throw them off. If he's yet to make a kinyan on them, even though they're sitting on his mats, and even though he's done the work, they're not his yet, and if the loveh pays it back, it goes back to him, and he gets to keep them. L'man d'amar, in Baba Batra, according to one who says, Kelav shelokeach bishut mocher, the utensils of the purchaser, when they're in the place of the seller, kana lokeach, the lokeach is successful in making a kinyan, Afilu delag binu besisne kananu. Even if he doesn't lift them up in the baskets, he will be koneh them because his kelim are koneh on his behalf, even in the presence of the mocher. And therefore, he's koneh them right away. And Rashi says here, even on the mats themselves. Lefi shekanu lo machtalotav shein kelav. Because the machalatzot, which are his kelim, acted on his behalf to acquire the tmarim. So if your kelim can work, the buyer's kelim can work in the property of the mocher to be working on his behalf as if it's his chatzer or they are his proxies, then it works even if he didn't collect the dates yet and they fell on his mats, they're already his. But if you don't hold that, then only if he made a kinyan on them somehow do they become his. But the point is that as soon as the borrower comes and repays it, he gets back the property plus anything that's there, that the buyer or lender has yet to make a kinyan on. That's the point of what they're suggesting. So Gemara says, Pshita, ba'atra de misalke, in a place where the minug is that the borrower has a right to buy back the land or the mashkon at any point, v'amarlo lo mistalkna, and he says, I want to set up the transaction that you can't throw me off the land. Hakamerle de lo mistalkna, he said, or he agreed to the fact that he's not going to remove him from the property. They can agree. He's stipulating that this transaction or this loan will be in a way that when I get the mashkon, you have no right to remove me from the land. El ba'atra de lo misalke, in a place where the normal situation is that the borrower has no rights to throw him off the land, he gets to keep it for that fixed duration. V'amar mistalkanum, and he says, you can remove me from it. My, what is the din over there? Tzarech the mikna minei? Do you need a kinyan or lo? Or do you not need a kinyan? Rapapa amar, lo tzarech the mikna minei. Rapapa says you don't have to make a kinyan in order to make that enforceable. Sheshin breder media amar, tzarech the mikna minei. You do have to make a kinyan in order to make it enforceable. Behilchata, tzarech the mikna minei. And the halacha is that you do have to make a kinyan. Now Rashi explains what the reasoning is over here. In the case where he goes against the minhag makom, where they normally allow you to buy it out, and over here it says, I'm not going to give it back to you, B'shat matan ma'ot. Rashi says it happened at the time of the transaction itself. You can see the oat bet in the Gra. The Gra says that the Rambam, the Ramban and the Rashbam and Farshim afilu achar matan ma'ot. The Ramban and the Rashba believe that even after you've given the money, you can make such a stipulation. Hitna amanach lo duchala salkeni. It works that you can say to him, you can't throw me off the land, or you can't buy this back for a fixed duration, whatever we agree to. V'karka nikne bekesef. And the kinyan for karka is through kesef. Ben derech mekach, ben derech skirut, ben b'chol drachim, k'fiyat tanai. Whatever you guys agree to, when he gives over the money, then the kinyan on the karka works based on whatever you stipulated, and that is what creates the finality or the gemira to the agreement over here. And since you agreed that you're going to leave him on the property, that's fine. On the other hand, in a place where they normally, the fixed or the minhag is that you stay on the land for the fixed duration, you have no rights to buy it back, and now the loved, the borrower, wants the right to be able to buy it back, then it's dibura alma, because there was no kinyan that made it that he would be able to enforce it. That's the question here. Do you need a kinyan to give that right to the borrower? It's one thing when it's the seller's rights over here. When the seller says, I'm going to keep it, even though that's not the minhag, that's a benefit to him. That's a right to him. He acquires that with the money that he buys the karka with. On the other hand, from the perspective of the loveh, he's not making any kinyan here. He's simply giving his karka to the other person who's making the kinyan. So does his lack of kinyan then make it that he doesn't have a right to make this stipulation and have it be binding? Or is it binding even if he makes it a verbal commitment? Even if he just says it verbally, it's incorporated in the transaction. And the Gemara says in the end, Be'ilchata, that you need a kinyan in order to make it enforceable. The Bali Tosafot say, Ein the Faresh, don't say the reason you need a kinyan here is Mishum de Malve Ka'amar, Mistalakalna, is because the Malve, the creditor, is the one who's saying it, Babi Ptume Milme, and it's just him saying something for the Loveh to make him happy. Because the Loveh violates Nuye. Because the condition should have come from the debtor and not from the creditor. Don't say that that's the problem over here. That who person articulating it is the wrong person, like we saw 2 days ago in the daf, that whenever you say something, it's the wrong party that's making the stipulation, then they're just making the person feel good, but they're not really committing to it. So don't say that's the reason over here. Denire da'ari lachar shalavai menu stam. Because it looks like, or the case here is after he borrowed from him stam. Because then you need a kinyan so that he won't back out of it. If it happened at the beginning of the loan, then even in a place where they don't normally throw people off the land, this guy is screaming that these are the conditions. The buyer can only make a kinyan on what which the seller is giving over to him. And if he's stating that this is my stipulated condition for giving it over to you, that's incorporated in the kinyan. So you can see in the old gimel of the Bali HaTosafot that aval the Rambam enu mechalek b'choze. The Rambam makes no distinction like this. It seems that that's the same as the din in the shat halva, and that seems to be Rashi's reasoning also, b'shat matan ma'ot, that it's at the time of the ma'ot. And that's why Rambam and the Rashi are the same. That Rambam and the Rashi believe that it doesn't matter when this stipulation happens, whether at the time of the transaction or later, you need a kinyan in order to make it enforceable from the side of the borrower. Then the Bali HaTosafot, the Rashba, the Ramban, all believe that it was not at the time of the loan. It was at the time of the loan. It's incorporated into the kinyan of the loan. And then whatever was stipulated is stipulated and it's binding. But after the fact, you want to do this. In order to make it enforceable, you have to have a kinyan to make it enforceable. Now, Gemara says, Amar, if he says to him, Izel v'ayti zuzei, I'm going to get the money to pay for it. Lo achil, don't eat anymore. He says, I'm going to get the cash. I'm ready to pay you for it. I'm ready to redeem the property from you. And since I have the money ready to go, you're not allowed to eat from it anymore. He's not allowed to eat from it anymore because, in essence, is saying we've terminated the transaction now, and whatever you eat at this point is going to be problematic because I'm about to bring you the money. Izel ve'etrach v'itezuze says, listen, I'm going to get the money now to pay you back, but now that he has the money in hand and he's going, I'm just going to get the money, I'm going to deliver it to you, he says, I'm going to go find the money to pay you to take the property away from you. Ravina. So in the first case, the money is ready to go, and he has a right to buy it back. It's an atra de misalki, as Rashi says. It's a place where you're allowed to buy it back at any time. Since he has the money ready to give to him, he can say to him, stop eating, I have the money, I'm going to bring it to you. Just got to go home and get you the money. The other hand, if he says, listen, I'm going to go get round up the money now, and then I'm going to pay you. Ravina says you can keep eating. He says you can't eat. And the halacha is that you can't eat. So since the money is not ready yet, so in that case, Ravina says that he has more time. There's no guarantee he's going to show up the money. There's no guarantee that he's going to collect all the money that he needs to pay it off. And therefore, he can continue eating until there's something more certain. Now then, Marzucha Breda Ramari says, if the guy is already telling you this information, that means that he probably has a good lead or a good sense that he's going to be able to follow through on this. And if he's telling you that he's going to bring you the money, you've got to give him the benefit of the doubt. And therefore, you have to stop eating because you've got to assume that he's about to redeem the property from you. Rav Kana, Rav Papa, Rav Ashi, Lo Achil Ben Echaita. Kana, Rav Papa, Rav Ashi didn't eat with a Mashkom Ben Echaita, similar to the statement that we saw from Rava earlier that a Tzuber Midirabanan shouldn't be doing this. Ravina Achal Ben Echaita. Ravina did eat Ben Echaita. Amar Mar Zutra, my time of demand Achil Ben Echaita. What is the reasoning behind the one who thinks, or Ravina here, who says that you can't eat on a field with the defeasance of the loan as you take the payroll of production of the field? Again, it's not where he's paying the true value of what he eats. He's giving a fixed payment per year to eat whatever's there, whether he gets more than that or less than that. It's similar to a steachuza, which is a field that is an inherited property of a person. Steachuza lav afagav de achil peyre tuva amar rachmanan kaparik la ba'arba zuzay. Doesn't it work this way, that no matter how much the person eats, you have a right to go and redeem it for the four zuz? Hachanami lo shna. Therefore, here it makes no difference as well. Istei achuza, your maktish to hekdesh, then hekdesh sells it back or assesses the value of the field based on the number of years until the yovel. And the Torah specifies that it is a fixed payment per year. It's based on the years of the yovel, but it turns out to be a sela upundion l'shana. It's one sela and a pundion per year. That way you get to 49 sela and 49 pundionim. 48 pundionim makes up a sela. And so therefore you're really paying 50 sela or sela per year. But it's only over 49 years because the 50th year is the yovel. So if you take 50 sela and you divide it by 49, you get a sela and pundion per year. And there's one extra pundion, which the Gemara in Arachin discusses what the point of that is. That's a payment for the changing of the money. But there is the fixed amount. So therefore, then when you eat peirot every year, we don't assess the value of how much you ate each year. We don't say, well, you're giving money or you are paying money to the Hekdesh. And therefore, it's the equivalent of a loan. And now you're getting back more than the value of what you paid. Because over there, by a steachuzah, it's a fixed payment. It's not based on the true value of the land. It's based on a fixed payment. So even though it's a fixed payment, we still say, no problem, that you can eat as much as you want during the year, and that's not considered to be a rebate. So there, when the machmana amar, kaparik la ba'arba zuzay, you pay basically four zuz per year, or a seller per year. So hachanami lo shna, so do over here. When I pay a fixed amount per year to defease the loan, I'm allowed to eat whatever the payroll produced, no matter how much that is. Umanda asar amar, the one who says asur, malacha steachuza hekdeshi. Wait a minute. When you're talking about a steachuza that's hekdesh, rachmana ukma pijon. The Torah gave you a fixed payment there. Over there, the steachuza belongs to hekdesh, and it's the equivalent of a sale. It's structured as you gave it to hekdesh, now hekdesh is selling it back to you, and they sell it back to you at a fixed price. Hacha halvohi umechse keribit. On the other hand, here, it's all a loan. It's clear that it's a loan, and the mashkon that you're taking is collateral for a loan. And therefore, when you eat it at a fixed price per year, and then you start to get in excess of the amount that you're defeasing from the loan, it looks like ribit. And therefore, we don't want you to do it. Again, it seems that the mashkon, or this, doing this v'nechaita, might be mutar me'ikar adin, But optically, it looks like a Vakri beat, and that's why the Rabbanan didn't want to participate or do this because of the way it looked. Valachta, that it should be yashar, that they should be above that, or be much more clear that they're not taking interest, even though it might be okay from the letter of the law. Tosfot over here asks the question, or the point that we're making, which is, didn't we say before Rava says that Tzur Meir Rabbanan shouldn't do this? So even if Ravina has a reason why it's mutar, why does he over here go against that position of Rava? That Ravina didn't want to classify himself as a Tzur Meir Rabbanan. He was an onof. Vod nimtza muge b'sifrosh Rabbeinu Tam, Rafram b'mkom Ravina, b'plukta de kitzuta. Another thing is that in the machloket b'kitzuta, he has Rafram and not Ravina. V'yesh mefarim, d'had nechaita de Ravina, hainu kitzuta. There's some that say that this nechaita over here is not the classic nechaita, but the nechaita is the kitzuta that we mentioned above, which the Rabbanan allowed. V'kaimelon de Ravina l'kula, and we paskin like Ravina l'kula. V'nirish gam Rabbeinu Chananel, sover kein, shepasak de kaimelon kravashi, d'lo achil menachaita. Velo shari the tzur midravana ela kemashkanta de sura. In kain return lamar the nechaita the hacha I have a kitzuta. But the lo shari ela kemashkanta de sura, because he says that it is mutar kemashkanta de sura, but that must be what's going on over here. So you have to explain why Ravina says it's mutar. So one way to say it is that they're arguing about Rava's statement before and saying whether that's the case or not. That might be one possibility. Tosfot's unwilling to accept that. Tosfot says so either it's that Ravina didn't think of himself as a tzur midravana. That's hard based on the fourth parak in the Gemara in Pesachim, which is that in certain instances, it's one thing to say you're not a Tzur Meir Rabbanan when it comes to a Chumrah. But when it comes to a Kula, to say that you're not a Tzur Meir Rabbanan, that's not really being an Unov. That's really being someone who is saying, I'm not a Tzur Meir Rabbanan, therefore I don't have to keep these extra laws that are there. That's a little less so, and I think that's harder to say in these situations. Or the last possibility is that the case here is not a case of nechaita, but kitzuta. And they're arguing in this similar machloket that we had before, which is b'kitzuta pligi baravacha v'ravina, that they argue over there. Then this would determine which side Ravina was on in the kitzuta case. And that's why we said the Rabbeinu Tam said that it was Rafram and not Ravina before. Because otherwise we'd know whose opinion was what over here, because Ravina then would indicate to us that b'kitzuta he thinks it's mutar. So therefore, he says that the Girsa before was not Ravina. But then the Baal Tosfot would say that that's the case. And therefore, the Locha is like Ravina Lekula, but only in the case of Kitzuta, not in the case of Mashkona Dinechaita. Okay, we're going to stop here, four lines down on the top of Samachet Amud Aleph.